Welcome to Electronically Yours with Martin Ware.
Hi, it's Martin here, Electronically Yours. As always, happy to be in your company today. The guest I've just talked to is Paul Humphreys from Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. We've been friends for a long time now. He used to be partners with Claudia Brooken, who's a close friend of ours. And he's just a really interesting, decent, regular guy. You know, he's a great guy. He's a very good songwriter. Made an incredible career himself and Andy McCluskey. We started at almost identical times. We are like, you know, the early Human League and Orchestral Maneuvers were like two peas in a pod, essentially. And we had parallel career paths to a certain extent. They probably sold a few more records than us, I think. I am, you know, very happy with Orchestral Maneuvers. They've written some incredible songs. And I love their artistic approach. Paul's a great guy. He's really a real sweetheart. And I'm not surprised that him and Andy have done really well in the business. Because, you know, they're the kind of people you want to be around. You know, they're reliable. They are positive-minded people. They're talented. They're just, you know, very, very good and professional. And I love them both. They're both great guys. So anyway, here is Paul Humphreys from Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. What gig are you doing? What's the OMD gig?
Yeah, we're hoping to do a few festivals. We're supposed to be headlining the Let's Rocks, but we haven't had a complete green light on that one yet. But we're doing the one I've come over for is we're doing the Indigo, O2 Indigo. It's like a charity gig we're doing. Yeah, and we're doing, it's like it's a pay-per-view thing all around the world, basically. So it's like camera and everything, but we're just playing to nobody, which is going to be incredibly weird. But there's going to be a lot of people tuning in, so it's going to be, I mean, you know what it's like. You rely on the feedback of the crowd, don't you? So I mean, it's going to be a bit.
It's good. We're doing at the end of each number, it's going to be like.
Yeah, I know. It's going to be like the first gig we ever did in Eric's club. In Eric. You know? just my brother in the audience going.
Very good.
Yeah. That's funny. Don't give up your day job.
Have you got plenty of subscribers for that then?
Yeah, lots actually. Yeah, so it's good. But we're doing it for basically doing it for our crew, because a lot of our crew couldn't get furloughed, and so all the proceeds and all the merchandise sales and everything, we have special merchandise for it, we're just going to give to our crew, because they've been so loyal to us over the years. We have had the same guys for a long time that we kind of felt we owed it to them, really. So all the proceeds get split between them equally.
That's a very decent gesture on your part. I must say I'm very impressed. And I hope your fans appreciate it too, because, you know, they'll know that the money...
They do, and they've been supportive of it. And you know, knowing that it's for our crew, they've, you know, we've sold a lot of tickets for it, so...
Oh, brilliant. That's fantastic. And so how was it over in France? Were we having a nice time? Until this happened?
Yeah,
I mean, we got COVID.
Yeah, exactly. I got COVID there. But yeah, it's been nice. I mean, I've lived in London for over 20 years, you know, and my wife and I decided that we would try moving to France. I mean, it was, to be honest, you know, without getting on my high horse about Brexit, you know, it was Brexit had something to do with it, because my wife owns a perfume company. It's a French branded perfume company called Art de Parfum, but it's actually a British owned company paying British taxes. And she can't, because the perfume is, it's complicated, because the perfume is made in France, there will be a tariff bringing the perfume in from France to the UK and distribute it out to the EU. So,
it's not people anymore.
No, there's no way that will be profitable. So she's had to move all her business from London to France. So we thought we might as well just move there and try living there for a while. So we've moved down to the south of France. And it's really lovely.
Nice.
Yeah.
Plenty of sun. So tell us about growing up in, was it the Wirral?
Wirral, yeah.
Tell us about that.
Across the
was it, was it, was it a posh area or was it a...
Yeah, I mean, me and Andy were working class boys, you know, and we didn't have any money, but our parents managed to kind of sustain our life in a quite a posh area, you know, which is quite. At least it wasn't central Liverpool, because central Liverpool in the 70s was, you know, not a pleasant place to be.
It was like, you know, I remember Liverpool at that time was a, it was like some kind of post-war documentary. I thought
exactly what it was.
Yeah. Still kids with no shoes on playing football in the street and stuff.
Yeah, it really was like that in the 70s. Yeah. But you know, now Liverpool, thanks to the EU and their, you know, billions of investment in there, it's a great city now. You know, they basically bulldozed a whole part of the city and rebuilt it with the money from the EU. And it's a great city now.
It really is. I mean, I've done several art projects there, and they're such a thrusting and forward facing kind of, there's an attitude in the council and the people there that is like really quite impressive. It's almost like New Yorkian, you know, in its optimism.
Yeah, it is. There's a real vibrancy. Yeah, there's a real vibrancy. In the same way there is in Manchester these days as well. You know.
Yeah, yeah.
But Liverpool's a cool place.
Yeah.
No, true.
Unfortunately. That's fantastic. So tell us about when you started in bands in the 70s, you were in the id, is that right?
Yeah, I was in the id. I mean, initially, we were all kind of a school band, and I was the roadie. I couldn't play anything. So,
joined the club.
Because I my hobby was electronics as a kid, and you know, from being 12, I was doing circuits, you know, so they had a whole load of equipment that didn't work, so I used to go and help them when they did a gig at the school, in the school hall. I used to go and make sure that everything worked for them, and I kind of got interested in making music. And well, for Andy and I, because Andy was in this band called Equinox first. This was the school band. And I got friendly with Andy, and we both realized that we had an interest in electronic music. And so I started making like stupid, like ridiculous noise making machines that really weren't very musical at all. But we could, you know, process them through, you know, WEM copycats and things like that.
Yeah.
You know,
to make them.
And so we used to just have experiment. Then I thought, well, I need to learn how to play the keyboard. So I bought a piano, and then I joined Equinox, which then we changed the name to the id, but it was the same group of people. And then the id was like an 8-piece with like guitar solos and all of these things. And then Andy and I decided that we wanted to be more purist. Yeah, we wanted to be more purist. And so we used to just practice him, you know, write crazy electronic things in my mum's back room. And, but we were part of this sort of prog rock band because we thought no one would be interested in the kind of music we were making, you know, so it was really a hobby of experimentation, really. And it wasn't until, same for you, I'm sure. It wasn't until I heard, because we used to go over to Eric's Club in Liverpool. That was the place to be, you know. And we heard Daniel Miller, the Normal, Warm Leatherette. And we thought, wow, there's a movement here. You know, there's going to be, we're not the only people thinking, because, you know, this is pre-internet, isn't it? I mean, we had no idea what was going on in the rest of the country. I had no idea that you were doing similar things, and you probably had no idea we were doing similar things. And so when we heard the normal, we thought, wow, maybe there is something to this electronic music, you know, because we thought before that you know, when we, because we listened to Kraftwerk as kids, you know, and Neu and La Dusseldorf and all of these bands, and they were our primary influence, you know. But we thought, well, we can't actually be a proper electronic band. Sorry, I'm just, Andy just emailed me. Let me just turn that off. We thought that, you know, electronic music, to do it properly, we thought it would be prohibitively expensive. You know, Kraftwerk had all these amazing machines, and we were two working class boys from Liverpool. It's like, how can we do this and actually be a proper electronic band? But then the punk movement happened, and because we were going to Eric's all the time, Eric's was primarily a punk club, and we thought, well, maybe we should just be doing kind of punk on synths, you know. And we wrote Electricity, which, you know, when you think about it, like the song Electricity is kind of like a punk, it's like a punk electronic punk song, really. You know, it's really super fast and driving, and, you know, so it's like two fingers playing it, you know. Because I mean, also, you know, a lot of the electronic music was, you had to be proficient musician as well in those days to be taken seriously. But what punk gave us was this kind of new liberation where we could, you know, you could just get up on stage and do your own thing. You didn't have to be musically proficient. You just had to have something to say, you know. And
So what was your big break in terms of, were you signed first, or did you do support for bigger acts first?
Well, what happened was we were doing our own like small tours of the Northwest, playing, you know, pubs and clubs and stuff. And we played Eric's one night. We played Eric's, and there was some people there from Manchester saw us and said, why don't you come and play the Factory Club in Manchester? And it turned out that the Factory Club in Manchester was owned by Tony Wilson, who was about to start Factory Records. But he was a TV personality, for those who don't know, in Granada, and he used to put local bands on at the end of the news item. He used to give like airtime, you know, TV time to like really strange bands. I don't know how he got away with doing it, but he did. And so we just recorded Electricity on our four track, and we had a cassette of it. So when we met Tony at the club, we gave him the cassette just cheekily tried to get on the TV show. We had no idea he was starting a label. And then, anyway, we didn't hear anything for a few weeks, and we thought, oh, well, that's that. And then we get a call, and he said, well, I can't get you on the show, but I'm starting this label, Factory Records, and I think I really want to release Electricity on Factory Records. Right. Which was Fact 6.
And you sang on that, right? You sang that, that's right. Is that right?
Yeah, me and Andy sung it together, but in the recording, I'm louder than him, actually, on it. Yeah. But actually, the true story is that Tony's wife, Tony wasn't sure about Electricity. He wasn't sure he liked it, but it ended up in a bag in their car. And Tony's wife was going through the bag of cassettes and said, oh, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, that sounds interesting. She put it in, and she said, you need to sign this. You need to sign this now.
Really?
So we kind of owe it to Tony's wife, really, yeah. So,
incredible. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Tony
went from not being sure to saying, we're going to sign you to Factory Records, but we're not big enough to handle you. We'll have to sell you on to a bigger label. And we said, yeah, sure. You know, we always thought Tony was a bit full of shit, you know. But what he did was he sent Electricity down to all the labels, and we got a hit from Dindisc, which was a subsidiary of Virgin, you know.
Carol Wilson,
yeah. So it all happened really ridiculously fast, to be honest. And we were like riding this roller coaster, and a door opened, and we thought, well, you know, let's just walk through it and see what happens. You know, I mean, we felt we were no hopers, to be honest. I mean, we really did. All our friends thought we were shit. You know, they really did.
I mean, it's a good lyric. It's a good lyric. All our friends thought we were shit. That should be an opening line of a song.
So I mean,
now Ma, look at me now.
I mean, we ended up signing a 7-album deal with Dindisc, right? And you know, we thought it was a good deal at the time, but it turned out it was complete crap. You know, we totally ripped off. But we thought it was a 7-album deal. We were on the dole. You know, it's
yeah.
Where do we sign? You know, when you think about lawyers and you know yeah. what does that percentage mean there? I've no idea. Let me just So, we ended up on business, but we still thought we were still budgeting for failure. So we took the first advance that we got from Dindisc, and instead of you know using it to buy food and stuff, we just bought equipment. We built a studio in the centre of Liverpool, just down from the Cavern, in Matthew Street, and we built a studio. And we thought, well, when we get found out and Virgin don't. Because we could see on these 7 albums that there was an option to dump us at the end of every album. So we thought, well, they're bound to dump us at the end of this album. So at least we'll go at the end of it and have a business. You know, so.
Yeah. Just to say that everything you've been talking about so far is almost the mirror image of what happened with the early Human League. Almost identical, in fact. You know, I mean, in terms of our attitude towards... We did the same thing. We invested just about everything into equipment and a studio because we just thought, you know, at least we'll have that. You know, we didn't know it was going to last.
Yeah, I mean, and also we were playing music that you know, electronic music is passé now. It's part of the, you know, it's part of everyday music. But electronic music then was. You know, it was an uphill struggle, really. I mean, even journalists didn't consider it real music, you know, and people had this kind of feeling that you know, synthesizers, they wrote the song for you, you know. And
Just press the button and everything.
The button.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Can't be real music, you know. They're not even writing that stuff. So, it was very easy to kind of not take yourself seriously because we knew what an uphill struggle it was. But what you and I didn't realize is that there was a movement beginning everywhere for electronic music. And we could ride that wave. We didn't know the wave was starting, but we were riding it anyway.
Yeah, I did an interview with Gary Newman, who I'd never met before the podcast, funnily enough. And his story is almost identical as well, except he was in a... You know, obviously a straightforward guitar band, rock band format. And he said he just went into a studio and saw there was
a move in the
studio.
Yeah.
And he started messing about with it. He said, right, we're going to rewrite all the album we've just come in to record. We're going to do it from scratch.
I think Beggar's Banquet had a heart attack at that point, didn't they? Because they thought they were getting a rock album.
Are you mates with Gary?
Yeah, know him really well, actually. Yeah, because you know, he gave us our first live break because, you know, Our Friends Electric was huge and Cars was huge. And we were just signing to Dindisc at that time. But we've been touring with Joy Division. We used to do the factory tours, and there was us, Joy Division, and a certain ratio all on the same bill, and we used to tour around. But we were still only playing, because Joy Division weren't that big then either. We were only playing kind of clubs. And all of a sudden we had this, So what happened was we were playing this club in London, and after we'd done our set, there was a knock on our dressing room door, and Gary walked in and said, to the gig and said, look, I'm doing this big tour and I'm looking for the right support band, and do you want to join me? And we said, Gary, that would be great, but I don't know how we can afford to do such a big tour. And you know, we've got no money. And he said, don't worry about it. You'll come on my bus. My crew will take care of all your gear. And I'll pay you enough to find a decent hotel every night.
Oh, how lovely.
Yeah.
Because people need to understand that in those days, the common thing was you had to pay good money to get onto tours.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what we did with Susie and the Banshees. We did two tours with
them. That's right, you did, yeah.
And we had, you know, Virgin were forking out 40 grand a tour, you know, for doing that. And
So we were lucky. Yeah, we were really lucky. And Gary was such a sweetheart. And we've never forgotten that gesture, you know. So we've always kept in touch with them.
Oh, that's lovely. I really like that. He seems like a very decent person. I'm surprised our paths never crossed in the past.
Yeah.
Anyway.
He's a lovely man. Yeah. He played the Royal Albert Hall last year and invited me down there, and I went backstage to see him. And, you know, he gave me such lovely big hug, you know. It was really great.
He's doing well. His new album is amazing, by the way.
Yeah, I know it is. I've heard it, yeah. Yeah, no, I think he's doing some great stuff at the moment. He's really reinvented himself, hasn't he?
He has, yeah. I'm a total... Well, I'm late to the party, but I'm a total fan now.
Yeah, no, me too. It's this really kind of dark, gothic, kind of slightly angry, I mean, it's sort of aggressive kind of sound, which I really like, you know.
He's kind of like the whole thing, the makeup and everything is fine.
Yeah, the image he's in reinvented. He's reinvented himself really well, image-wise as well. No, I love Gary.
Yeah, he's great. Okay, so tell me about you and Andy's relationship. I'm fascinated by it because, you know, I know you really, really well, and obviously I know Andy as well, but I know you better because of Claudia and all that stuff. And tell me about how your relationship has evolved over the years.
Well, I first met Andy. We've known each other since we were 7 years old. You know that? We went to primary school.
Get up.
Yeah, yeah. So we're like brothers, you know. We spent most of our lives together. And we're quite different people, you know. And I think musically, the fact that we're quite different people and we approach things in completely different ways is the OMD sound, I think. Because I still think the best songs we've written together, pretty much, with the exception of a couple, the best songs we've written have been written together, you know. Because I think we just have this kind of chemistry that's, you know, you can't describe it, but we just have this chemistry, and we'll walk into a room to write songs, and the end of the day we'll come out with something that's really interesting together. You know, because I think we've realized this recently that we've been trying to do a new album, but I've been down in France and I haven't been able to move. I can't fly up to Liverpool. He can't fly down to France. And we're trying to write a new album. And you know, we've got a few really good songs, but it's been difficult because the way we work best is that chemistry in a room together, all our stuff we've written together, you know. And, you know, I'll come in. One of us has to come in with an idea, either, you know, if it's a lyric idea or a title of a song or whatever, or a sound idea, someone just tosses it into the room and then we just bat it between us all day or all week or whatever, and then we'll come up with something good. And I've written with a lot of different people, but I've never had that same thing as I have with Andy. You know, he's I've got an incredible amount of respect for him as a songwriter, you know. But what Andy is really brilliant at is lyrics. I think some of his lyrics are amazing. And he's great at top line vocals. You know, he can write a catchy tune. Yeah. And I can write a catchy keyboard tune. And so between us, right, you know, we've done some good things.
So is it similar to the kind of Vince Clarke, Andy Bell thing, do you think, in a way?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. They need each other, and Andy and I, we really need each other, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and I really do love writing songs with Andy. He's just a great person to write with, and he has really interesting ideas. Sometimes his ideas are just so far out that I'll have to reel them back in, you know. But I love that, because if he hadn't had that far out idea, we wouldn't have had developed it into something a bit more, you know, palatable.
Well, it's interesting. On your Wikipedia site, it says something to the effect of Andy McCluskey, and this sounds like an insult to you, it's not, is the kind of head, the intellect, and that you're the soul of the band. Do you think that's insulting, or is that accurate, or what do you think?
I can see what the quote is. I didn't write that, but I can see what the quote is. You know, because we do approach things in different ways. Andy is very conceptual. You know, he's far more conceptual. So the head is, you know, he'll come up with like the craziest idea for a song. You know, like, you know, he you know, like Enola Gay, for instance, you know, discovered the name of the plane that dropped the atom bomb on Hiroshima, and so we wrote a song about that, and you know, he'll come up with like the craziest ideas for songs. I mean, it all kind of stems as well from the fact that we never wanted to write cliched love songs, and Andy never wanted to write a cliched love song. So he's always gone out of his way to find subject matter for our songs, you know, and he's absolutely brilliant at it. You know, interesting.
We used to have a list on the wall in our studio of subjects that we couldn't use. And number one was we couldn't use the word love. We couldn't use the word world for some reason. I can't figure that one. And I wish I got that list now. It was really interesting. It was like that typical kind of bolshy kind of Sheffield thing is we will, this is our manifesto, you know. But actually it's a bit like, I liken it to an artist only having a limited number of colours in their palette, and that's what they choose to do, you know.
Yes, exactly.
Even on blue or something.
Yeah, I mean, we do that with music now. We approach it, we approach music like we're painting, because you know what it's like now with, I mean, when we first started synthesizers, they had, they were very limited, you know, well, our synthesizers anyway, we had a Korg Micro preset. It was variations of and we had to kind of process through, you know, all kinds of machines to make it sound decent, you know, but now we, these synths you have, you know, inordinate, thank you. amount of options, and you know, you can just get lost in all the possibilities and forget to write a song. And what we do now is particularly on the last album we did, Punishment to Luxury, we kind of decided on a palette to use for, so we didn't get lost in, you know, we kind of chose a certain amount of drums. So, I mean, you know, because, you know, Andy and I will sit down, we go, okay, we need some drums. So I've got 2,500 kick drums. Yeah. You've got 7,000 snare drums. Where do we begin? So now...
I've got a great snare drum. I've got a great story for you about that, which is when the League were making the second League album after the split, and we kept getting reports back from Bob Last, who was managing them and us at the same time, saying, I'm going to have to give this job up. I can't manage them anymore. They're in Air Studios at nearly £2,000 a day, and they just spent the last week auditioning kick drums and snares.
Yeah, exactly. And
it's driving Martin Rushen insane.
I bet it was. It's really important to approach music that way these days. Yeah. Create your palette. Right?
Absolutely. In terms of the way, I've always really admired the way that you've, as a band, have presented yourself to the general public. I mean, in terms of the conceptual nature of what you do, I think it gives you an enormous strength, because on the one side, you've got all these really catchy pop songs and conceptual depth with the lyrics, but you've got the amazing Peter Saville, you know, and all the depth that that gives. And I'm a big fan of graphic design, as you know. I'm big mates with Malcolm Garrett, who came out of Manchester at the same time, Peter Saville,
exactly.
And also Ben Kelly and all that mob.
Ben Kelly, Ben Kelly did our.
So tell me about. Yeah, I'll tell you. Tell me how you met Peter Saville.
Yeah, funny actually, because we went into it for a meeting with Tony Wilson at Factory, and there was Peter, And he said, I've got this great idea for your sleeve. He said, it's going to be a black sleeve with black writing on it. And we thought, black sleeve with black writing, really? But, you know, we thought, well, that sounds like something interesting, because it was thermographed, you know, sort of, so it's slightly shiny on the
mat. Like lacquered, yeah.
Yeah, it's like lacquered, yeah. So we met in there, and we loved that sleeve, and you know, that won an award, that sleeve. So, but we didn't think about Peter anymore for a while, because we just signed to Dindisc, and we thought, oh, well, we'll be having to use the in-house art people at Dindisc now. So we go for our first meeting at Dindisc. We walk up the stairs, and there's Peter Saville. I said, Peter, what are you doing here? And he said, you just hired me as the art director for Dindisc.
Oh, brilliant.
So brilliant. It was like, you know. so that's why Peter did all our sleeves.
That's fantastic. I think I'm sure people do. They could take those sleeves and put them in a gallery format, and they look great. You know, I've always had a big admiration for that sort of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. There was an exhibition at the Design Museum in London with all our sleeves in there, and it was really kind of weird to see all our records as pieces of art, you know, but that's essentially what they were. They were pieces of art and that people created, you know. It was a nightmare to work with, you know, because it was always, Andy says this about me actually, but he was always incredibly last minute. And, you know, we'd have the record done and it was all ready to go to manufacture and we still didn't have a sleeve. And I remember once Andy and I got on a train from Liverpool to London, and we just went to his house and just hammered on his door, and he didn't come down. We knew he was home, so we just kept hammering on the door, and Peter opens the door in his dressing gown, and we just kind of barged in and said, right, today, Peter, you're doing our sleeve. I can't remember which sleeve it was, but we're not leaving until it's done.
Oh, wow.
So it was kind of slightly difficult to work with, but, you know, it was always worth it because his sleeves were incredible, you know. But it also stemmed from the fact that we didn't want, we didn't want to be celebrities. We had no interest in being celebrities at all, although, you know, in certain aspects, you can't help it because you go on Top of the Pops, you know, I don't know how many times, so people recognize you. But we didn't want to be celebrities. And so we thought, right, well, we'll keep our faces off as much as we can keep our faces off and just let the music speak for itself. And let's have a graphic design that that represents the songs that are inside. And so Peter...
I mean, with Hem 17, we had the same attitude, as you know, except our approach, instead of graphic design, was to use Ray Smith to create a kind of abstracted version or an impressionistic version of what we would be like. It's a bit like being the Archies or something, I think.
Yeah.
It's like more like mythical characters than reality. Because I always thought sleeves with just photos on is such a boring approach. Do you think?
Yeah. I mean, we caved into Virgin once, and on the Greatest Hits album, we had our faces on, but we weren't happy. But it was a deal done behind closed doors that we had to kind of do. But that was the only record we got our faces on.
Yeah. Based on the- I mean, Glenn always quite liked having his face on things. He's a rock star.
Yeah, Glenn.
You know, he loved that. So.
I've got nothing against that as well. I think that's fine. It's just how you want to present yourself, you know. And Andy and I just wanted to present ourselves as a piece of art and some interesting music inside, you know.
Did you and Andy go to art college?
Andy did. See, that's where we differ. Andy went to art college. Right. Andy comes from an art background, and I come from an electronics background and technical background.
Right.
And that's why we kind of worked together really well.
Perfect. And, you know, of course, Andy had a lot of success with different productions and stuff, especially Atomic Kitten and all that stuff. But, yeah. I mean, and you've had lots of side projects, obviously.
Yeah.
1-2 and... and what's it, the listening pool and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But did you, I, you know, forgive me if my research isn't in depth enough, but have you done lots of, have you done lots of third party production?
I do quite a lot of remixes for people. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I even did, I've just done an Erasure remix actually for,
have you?
It's going to be the, there's like a remix album. There's going to be a single released on the remix album and they've chosen my mix for it. So yeah. Which is great.
Oh, that's flattering, isn't it?
It is,
considering
yeah.
they do remixes for everybody else.
I also did it as a favour to Vince as well, because Vince and I get on really well anyway. And but Vince did an amazing remix of the Flip Side of Electricity. It was a song called Almost, and it was a very important song for Vince because. He went out and bought Electricity when he heard it on the radio, and he flipped it over and played Almost, and it just absolutely spoke to him. And he went out and bought a synth, and then started Depeche.
I know, yeah. He mentioned that to me.
So Almost was an important song to him. So he did an amazing remix for us for the 40th anniversary last year of Almost. Right. It's a beautiful remix. And so I was reciprocating and doing the Erasure, but I've done a couple of Erasure remixes before anyway. So,
right, I want to talk to you about your journey with synths, really. And I know you started off with the Micro, didn't you? And the Prophet 5, is that right?
Yeah, we also had some Rolands. We had the SH-01 and the SH-02. As well, and also we also had an MS-20.
MS-20 was great. I love them.
Right, they've reissued it now. You know, they're out again.
As a physical thing.
Physical thing, yeah.
Right. I might have to look at that. So the Korg, I'm looking at what it says on Wikipedia. May or may not be true.
Yeah.
But the Korg Trident. I don't know that machine. Is that a good
synth? Trident. I don't think we had a Trident. I think that's wrong.
All right, okay. But you said you used the Mellotron as well, a real Mellotron.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the thing was that we got into choral things because a friend of mine, Dave Hughes, who was in a band called Dalek, I Love You, a Liverpool band, and he started very early doing film soundtracks, and he still does film soundtracks now. But he was doing a film, and he hired a choir at Park Street Studios, Amazon Studios in Liverpool, and the choir was so good that he did. They finished early, and he was still paying them. So he said, "Okay, you're still going to work. I'm going to get you all to sing really, really long notes. Right? I'm going to get you to sing really long notes." And in a whole octave. And then he had them all on quarter inch tape, and I had a knock one evening on my studio, and it was Dave, and he said, "Look, I tell you what, if you will make tape loops out of these, I'll let you have a copy." So out of all, because you know, obviously this, you can only sing a song for a note for like, you know, 10 seconds or something.
Yeah.
So I made loops out of them, and then when he left, I started playing with these loops and created Souvenir, and we really liked what the choral sound did to our electronic sound because of the Souvenir. So then we thought, right, we need to have access to choirs now. So what did we? So you know, so it was the logical thing was to buy a Mellotron, and then the Mellotron.
They're heavy, aren't they?
Oh God, ridiculous! Yeah,
we've taken them on tour. Oh my God, we have tried carrying them upstairs. Jesus Christ!
Yeah, that was unbelievable. but yeah, the Mellotron was fantastic.
Yeah,
loved it.
I love it. I always wanted one. I was offered one of Moody Blues Mellotrons, and I thought I really want it, but then they were asking too much money for it because I used to love the Moody Blues. I thought they were great.
Moody Blues are great.
And then the Vox Jaguar. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Yeah, cheesy organs. We did a good line in cheesy organs in early R&D as well. We had Vox Jaguar, we had an Elgam, we had a Farfisa.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, the Four Feaster had a great drum box in it, and we used that drum box a lot. It had one of those, and it had that accompaniment thing, doo 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 doo, you know. but we used it on a song called Statues, actually, and it's a really beautiful song. Just kind of messed it up a bit. But.
And then, of course, we all moved into kind of Fairlight and emulator territory, where things started getting more serious, really. You could do anything with those buggers. I was still very disappointed with the sound of the Fairlight, but we used it for a couple of albums, I think, before. But I thought the emulator was fantastic.
The emulator was brilliant. And the emulator really kind of changed our direction as a band, really, because, you know, we were always into sort of music concrete and using found sounds. And
yeah.
We used to sample on our before there were samplers, but our way of sampling was to put it on quarter inch tape and then fire it in, you know, on the play button, which was essentially, you know, analog sampling in a way. So all of a sudden we had this machine that we could put anything into. So we did Dazzle Chips. We got an emulator, and the first we gave was Dazzle Chips, and you know, it almost ended our career. That album, because it was a commercial disaster. But you know, people think that's our masterpiece, and so many bands like Radiohead and people, you know, like Dazzle really.
Me too.
It nearly killed us, but I really thought Virgin were going to drop us then.
Yeah, really they get you in the end, don't worry.
Yeah,
I love a quote. I love a quote that somebody said about you. In fact, it was in another interview I was reading of yours, and I'm sure you've said this several times, but the idea that people wanted you to be either, you know, Stockhausen or ABBA, and you said, why can't we be both?
Yeah.
And I really like that.
I mean, that's kind of how we approach things. I mean, you know, the thing was, we loved our experimentation. We always love to experiment and do the full of like really odd, strange pieces. They still are, you know. But we also realized that we had a knack for a good catchy tune. And we like a good catchy tune as well, you know.
Yeah, and what's wrong with that?
We tried to put tunes in our more experimental pieces as well, because, you know, we don't want to be experimental for experimental sake. You know, we like to, you know, just like this is this weird idea and you hear it once and you go, okay, I don't want to hear it again. Interesting, but I don't want to hear it again. So you know, we really respected ABBA, and we thought they had the most amazing knack of writing an incredible catchy tune, and maybe subliminally we kind of took a few things from them.
I really like what I like about your career and the way, you know, obviously you carried on with OMD until 89, and then you did 1-2 with Claudia. I didn't realize that was 13 years, right? Is that correct?
I know. Yeah, I know.
I had no idea. And I love the fact that you were doing things because you just really believe and always really believed in them. And it's like
I never wrote one song for commercial success. You know, I think if you try to write a hit, you're on a losing wicket there already. You know, you have to just do what you believe.
Do you teach?
No, I don't actually.
All right, because everything you're saying is what I tell my students. I said, if ever in my career I have been tempted, or occasionally I've tried it, to do things for commercial reasons, the money always runs away. And then if I do things from the heart and for artistic reasons, it attracts people. Exactly. And it's hard to make young people understand that now, I think.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, when we were starting out, it was really cool to be different and try different things and be different. In today's society, everyone wants to be the same. Everything's, you know, so much music is generic. You know, it's really annoying. But I mean, there are some great things out there. You know, there are some really interesting things out there. Oh. But you know, in the pop charts, everything is just incredibly generic for me. I just
I think a lot of them are interchangeable. I mean, if you took the vocals off them, you could probably switch the backing tracks and just change the vocalists around, and you wouldn't know the difference. Yeah. Which is really depressing if you think about it. Okay, so tell me what were you most proud of with 1-2 in terms of your output?
I think the Instead album was a really good album that we did.
Right.
I think Claudia is a really good songwriter as well. You know, she's a really good songwriter and an amazing singer. I mean, we had a long relationship with her, but you know, I met her through work because. I had a label in Liverpool called Telegraph Records, and I had China Crisis signed to them, and I had Pete Coyle and Lotus Eaters signed, and several other artists I was developing. And I went to Cannes to try to sell to Cannes Music Festival to try to sell, you know, the business one, try to sell my labels and the bands to other labels around the world. And someone approached me, and I thought they were interested in one of my bands, but they were representing Claudia, and she was looking for songwriters. And so that's how I met Claudia. And we hit it off musically really, really early, you know. Because
she's a conceptualist as well.
Right. That's right. So that's why we kind of hit it off. And
So good. So that's that. And then, so if we come up to the present, are you writing any new orchestral maneuvers material currently?
Yes, we are. Yeah, we're writing. We've got a handful of songs for the new album already, but it's just taken a while because, you know, we're not sitting in the same room. I'm going up to rehearse for the show next week, and so. So we only rehearse for about 2 or 3 hours a day, just because, you know, for the drummer, it's like too physical to go more than 3 hours of batting the drums. So we only work for like 3 hours a day to run through the show a few times. And then I'm going to go back to Andy's house and we're going to spend some time writing.
So I'm looking forward. And when do you anticipate that coming out? Have you got a label or do you put it out yourself?
No, what we do is we do an album and then find a home for it is what we've done. So. You know, we've used lots of different labels. We use 100% a lot in London, but we've released on Sony, BMG. You know, we just find a home for the right home for the album. Really, is what we try to do.
Right, right. Who does all the business stuff then?
We have a great manager, Mireille Davis, who's she's amazing, and she was actually a fan of the band, and she used to follow us around when she was a kid. Which is really sweet. So we've known Mireille since she was a teenager, but then she went to business school, and then she ended up working for loads of labels as in all kinds of capacities. She went into the music industry, and when Andy and I got back together in 2005, I think that was, we really needed a manager, and we knew how good Mireille was and how respected she is in the industry. So we begged her. And she kept saying no. We just kept begging her until she said yes, really.
Really?
So she's
great. Sweet. And one more thing is, we've both done Night of the Proms in Germany, yeah. Which, you've done it lots, but we only did it for one tour. And I keep going back to it thinking, what an incredible concept that is. It really works, doesn't it?
I mean, I really thought it wouldn't work. And but we were flown in to see it. We kept saying no, and we were flown in to see it for like on a jolly, you know. And we watched it and went, God, this actually does work. You know, you've got a full orchestra playing to like 20,000 people or something in a massive arena.
Yeah.
these lights and stuff, but it's somehow and playing you know, pop songs, mixing pop and classical together, and all kinds of musical genres, you know, opera and everything, and you would think it wouldn't work, but it does. It works fantastically well.
It does. It's incredible. And the fact they sell all their tickets way in advance, don't they? They sell them
before they even know what artists are playing,
in advance, without even knowing who's going to be doing it.
Yeah, they're just buying into the concept because they know it works. Yeah. You know, and when Andy and I got back together in 2005, that was the first thing we did. And part of one of the things we said to each other when we got back together, we said, look, let's just do lots of things we've never done before. Never played with an orchestra. And so when we saw it and we realized that it worked, we loved it. We loved it. We've gone back and done it quite a few times. We've done Germany twice. We've done Spain. We've done all over Belgium, Holland. You know, a couple of times.
It's great. I love it. And I always point people at those things for different artists, because I just think, when else are you going to get a chance to do that? I mean, you know, we couldn't organise a tour where we employ an 80-piece orchestra and a 30-piece choir. It's impossible. Yeah, exactly. So,
but what I loved about it as well was the terror aspect of it for me, because you know, I like to be pushed, you know, and have boundaries pushed. Yeah. And to play, I mean, the orchestra were incredible musicians. And to get up on stage and play with these musicians behind you, you know, you couldn't make a mistake. You know, bluff it off. You know, make a few errors, and the band just for a minute, and that's it, and nobody notices. But if you make a mistake with an orchestra, the whole orchestra glares at you, going, "You put it down." But I love that discipline to have to play really well. You know.
Yeah. The thing is, we're both self-taught musicians, do you know, an awful lot of people are self-taught that I've interviewed and who I admire, and I just wonder what the relationship is between being self-taught and creativity. I'm pretty sure there's a strong correlation there.
Well, I think there is. I mean, I think if you're taught music, you're instantly taught to play other people's music. And so you're not applying any kind of creativity to that. You're applying technique to someone else's music.
Yeah.
But with us, I couldn't play anybody else's music. I could only play the songs I wrote. Or, you know.
So
instantly when I sat down and played, it was writing something or playing one of my things, and that's, you know,
or composing to tape as well. Arranging direct to tape, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
That's what I think. Okay, so this is the, we're getting close to the end, yeah. But we know I ask you a bunch of stupid smash hits type questions now. Okay. So this is the fun bit. It's supposed to be fun, but it's turned out to be quite illuminating when you contrast and compare between the different people. So, okay, what's your favourite film?
Favourite film?
One of them.
I don't know. This is a really tricky question.
Sorry, nobody's going to hold you to it.
I like so many films. I like a lot of kind of French art films. I like some Hollywood blockbusters. It's kind of hard to put my finger on.
I'll just pick one.
Okay. I watched Almost Famous the other day, and I thought that was fantastic.
Oh yeah, it's a great film.
Really is. Particularly being a musician, seeing what they go through.
Yeah. Okay. Your favorite book?
Favorite book. I think. Gosh, this is difficult, isn't it? I wish you'd told me this before. I could have prepared.
Well, it's just meant to be a spontaneous reaction. That's why I don't give you any advance warning. It's like just anything that kind of pops into your mind. It's a bit like a Rorschach test.
Yeah, I'm not that sharp today. I was up all night. I've got a new baby, you know. I'm 60.
I remember that.
I've got a new baby.
Oh, no, you need to keep it in your trousers, mate.
I know. I've been told that all my life, and it's never
happened. Too late.
And she,
all right, just we'll had a bypass the book.
Yeah, all right. Bypass the book.
Sorry, we'll bypass the book. What's your favorite, a moment in your life that kind of changed you forever or changed the direction of your life?
I mean, there's been several
moments.
I think this is kind of a poignant thing, really, because my family were going to move to Australia when I was a kid, because my dad was in the Australian Army, and he was I'll try to keep the story short, but he was a prisoner of war. He was forced to work for the Nazis as a lumberjack when he was captured, and he was quite ill when he came out of, you know, he nearly died in the prison camp, but he managed to survive. He managed to survive long enough to have three kids, and I was the last one. But he died 2 years after I was born. And so moving to Australia was out, and we were living in London because I was actually born in London. But my mum's sister lived in on the Wirral. And so my mum's sister said, come to the Wirral. You can't look after three kids by yourself in London. Sell your house. You can buy a much cheaper house up here and live up on the Wirral. And that was probably, my life would have been a lot different if I'd moved to Australia, you know.
Crikey, yeah. Wow, that's deep. It's a good story, though. Thank you for that. Other musical artist or composer?
Ralph Hutter. I'm from inside.
Ralph Hutter. Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
And do you like classical music? Are you a fan of classical music at all?
I do like some, but I'm not a big fan, really.
Okay. Ambition yet to be fulfilled.
You live till I'm 100. It's not fulfilled yet, but that's my ambition.
I like that. Oh, that's good. Okay, favorite visual or conceptual artist, and you can't say Andy.
I've always been a massive fan of Picasso. You know, Picasso just does it for me. You know, I like Mondrian.
Yeah.
I like kind of impressionists as well. Yeah.
Which of your own work is your favourite?
I mean, it's hard to pick songs, isn't it? It's like picking your favourite child. You know, it's not possible to do that. But I think album-wise, we've made a lot of albums, but I think three of our albums really stand out and that I'm really proud of. One is Architecture Morality, one is Dazzle Shifts, and our last album, The Punishment of Luxury, I'm very, very proud of. It's
fantastic.
Yeah.
And I think I agree with you on those three albums, by the way, definitely.
Yeah, have you heard Have you heard The Punishment?
I've heard some of it, yeah. I've not heard it all, but the tracks I've heard are really like. Finally, the final question is your favourite synthesizer.
Favourite synthesizer. That's also like asking what's your favourite child, isn't it?
Really? Yeah. except they're not going to get offended if you pick one.
Exactly. Not going to be offended. So I'll go for the Micro Preset because it started a whole life. Called Micro.
Yeah, I think so.
It started a whole.
Do you know what?
A whole life.
Yeah. This has been, I have to tell you that of the 50 or so interviews I've done so far, there's only one synth that has been duplicated when I've asked that question.
Really?
Which was a VCS3, yeah. Everybody else has picked different synths.
See, we had a VCS3 and I struggled to make anything decent out of it. Eno managed it. It's a different character. Yeah. Eno, made a career out of that. You know, because the Roxy stuff was VCS3, wasn't it? All the Roxy stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Paul, it's been an absolute pleasure. I knew it would be. This would, you know, we get on really well.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
I
don't see you enough.
Yeah, I know. Well, nobody sees anybody enough nowadays.
We should do more.
Are you going to be based in, are you still going to stay in France?
Yeah, but I'll be coming over. Well, when the quarantine thing goes and we get back to normal, I'll be coming over to London a lot. It's just a pain in the side right now to just, I can't just hop in and hop out, you know, so.
Yeah. Telling me. Well, please give us a shout, you know, when you're in, and we'll get down to the Groucho Club and have a drink.
Yeah, let's definitely do that.
And that'll be good. All right, man. And send my love to your family, and don't you get catching COVID again, all right?
I know. I believe
no variants.
But no variants. I know.
All right, man. Thanks so much.
Okay.
I'll see you soon.
Yeah, see you soon. Lots of love.
Mate Paul, lovely guy, can't do enough for you. One of those kind of people. We all need those people in our lives. His attitude and career path and kind of guiding principle is very similar to mine. As I mentioned on the front, like two peas in a pod, really. And still seeking to be as creative as possible over the years, as we all are. And got a maximum respect for them. And they come from one of my favourite parts of the world, Liverpool. The pool. Got lots of good friends up there. And all I can say is that they are writing a new album and that should be worth looking forward to. They're doing some shows, as he mentioned, which you should try and tune into if you can. Particularly for their, because it's benefiting their road crew. And I am always interested in what they're going to come out with next and their artistic approach. Anyway, how is everyone? In London, the weather has improved. People's mood has improved. If you didn't know any difference, it looks almost normal. And, of course, the vaccination program is rolling out in a maximal way at the moment in the UK. Travelling internationally is still a major issue. And that's a worry. But apart from that, hopefully the gigs that we've got planned coming up soon are going to be on. I really hope so. It's looking that way. So let's just see what the government, so-called government, are advising about things like social distancing and capacity for venues and stuff like that. Before we get too overexcited. But I'm excited to be performing for you guys again with Hem17. And we are going to be doing quite a lot of gigs for the rest of the year, actually. The problem is, like, doing one-off gigs in Europe now is a major issue because of all the nonsense associated with the paperwork and stuff like that. But hopefully that will change. You never know. Some more emails. This is from my mate Malcolm Garrett. Hi, Em. Enjoying the podcast whenever I got some quiet moments. Great to listen to Mal from the Cabs. He's more chatty and enthusiastic about life than when I recall from the few times I met him, admittedly many years ago. Mark Gray. Loving the podcast, great to hear from a wide range of artists, greatest era of music. Your insights into the process of recording and characters in the industry are fascinating. Suggestions for guests. Benj Edwards, he's had a great album out about the history of synths called 20 Systems. David Sylvian, I'd love that. Gary Cobain from Future Sound of London. Phil and Paul Hartnell from Orbital. I know Paul, so that's a good idea. The Mysterious Aphex Twin. I'd love to get that. Max Richter, likewise. Chris Carter, yet another vote. The most voted for is Chris and Cozy, I suppose. Richard Kirk is an old mate of mine, but he's gone off radar. Bill Nelson, another vote for Bill. I'd be up for that. Alex Patterson from The Orb, possibly.
William Orbit. I know William, and I should ask him. Keep up the great work from Mark the Robot Salesman. Thank you. That's a niche. Hi, Martin. This is from Brian Wharton. Still loving the show and agree your early Sound of Heaven 17 infused total glamour in opposition to the politics that were reflected in your lyrics. Future guests could include Propaganda. Yeah, I'm still waiting for Claudia to tell me when we can do it. And what about the 90s group M People featuring Mike Pickering and Heather Small? I know both Mike and Heather quite well, but it's not really electronic, is it? Please email me. I will try and read out as many as I can on the podcasts. They're coming in at a rate of knots now, so forgive me if they don't get read out at in a timely manner. They might be delayed by a few weeks. I'm also thinking about reverting back to one episode a week during the summer, just so I am not completely pinned down to doing two episodes a week and I can have a bit of time off. So that may be in 2 or 3 weeks from now. This is like early June, so maybe from mid to late June I will go back to just Fridays for a while, just to let everybody catch up. So some people have actually said that I'm putting them out at such a rate of knots, the episodes, that they can't keep up as well. So that's another good reason to kind of just back off a little bit. And but I'm glad to say that everybody seems to be well. They claim to be loving it, and the listening figures seem to bear that out. I'm very pleased. I'm approaching 100,000 plays. I don't know what that means compared to everybody else, but I'm happy with it. And it's constantly pretty much in the top 20 or 30 of the podcast charts. And thank you. electronicallymartin@gmail.com. Martin with a Y, remember. Good ideas, bad ideas, comments. Try to keep the length of the emails under control. It's very flattering that you want to share your life story with me, but try and keep it pithy because I can't possibly read all those out. And suggestions for guests, of course. And even better, suggestions for ways that I can contact the guests if you've got any ideas. Soon I'm going to put a list out of people who I'm trying to either persuade or get in contact with, and I've not had any luck so far. And I'll do that probably on the next podcast that I do. So hope everybody's feeling a bit more cheerful. Things seem to be getting a little bit better, I'm glad to say. I hope you're all well and your families are well. And I will see you for the next exciting episode. Same bat time, same bat channel. Actually, it'll be... it might not be the same bat time, but it'll be the same bat channel. Bye!